LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Douglas Lane, who joins us to discuss Advocate for an Indefinite Human Lifespan, a new Zero Books title exploring the life extension techniques and technologies of Aubrey de Grey and the SENS Research Foundation. Human beings are perhaps unique among Earth's sentient beings in that from a relatively young age, we know that we are going to die. Despite this knowledge, and the fact that life and death are but two facets of the great cycle of creation and destruction, as a species we live in dread and denial of death, which remains one of the last great taboos. Some say we need to set death aside in order to live, while others claim that only acceptance of death allows us to truly come alive. Whatever the case, most of us are consciously or subconsciously terrified by the thought of our own annihilation. The religious cling to the hope held out by the promise of an afterlife, while the secular place their faith in a life well lived, free from comforting delusions. Medical and material advances have extended human life expectancy well beyond what it was in centuries gone by, but de Grey's radical vision is of humans living longer, much longer, and in good health. Beyond the contested limits of sometimes controversial medical interventions, de Grey's plans have already drawn many moral and ethical objections. What would we do with a thousand-year life? How would it affect love, family, work, and culture? And what of population and natural resources on an already groaning planet? Technology, we are assured, offers answers to all such doubts. And if the transhumanist wing of the life extension lobby have their way, a millennium of existence may one day seem like the blink of an eye. Augmented, upgraded, downloaded. For the man-machine of the future, death may be but a distant dream. But are we becoming God, or merely playing God? Hello and welcome, Doug, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Well, hey, thanks for having me.
Doug, today we're going to be talking about one of the little imprints, the Zero Books imprints, a series called Advancing Conversations, and this particular one has you speaking with Aubrey de Grey. The book's entitled Advocate for an Indefinite Human Lifespan. To get us started, just tell listeners a bit about yourself, the Zero Books imprint, and then finally about the Aubrey de Grey himself and basically the subject matter of the book.
Okay, so my name's Douglas Lane, and I am a novelist and a podcaster like you, and I'm also the publishing manager for an imprint out of the UK called Zero Books. Zero Books focuses on left theory mostly. We publish books on cultural criticism, left theory, political, just straight up political books on current events, and occasionally experimental fiction. So we have a wide array of things that we do, but it's always from what I consider to be some kind of left perspective. So that's the imprint in me. Aubrey de Grey. Aubrey de Grey is probably the most famous longevity researcher or advocate for an indefinite human lifespan around. He has got a big, long Rasputin beard and an interesting, eccentric manner. He's fond of hops, and he's also quite brilliant and a brilliant advocate for longevity or an indefinite human lifespan. And it's important to note that advocating for an indefinite human lifespan is not the same thing as advocating for immortality, or I'll just leave it there. It's not the same thing as trying to aim at immortality. An indefinite human lifespan just means that there would be no set biological limit on the human lifespan. It would be undetermined how long a person might live. It would be conquering aging.
Yeah, exactly. And initially, although you could make a theoretical case that somewhere down the line, indefinite might add up to almost as good as immortal in the sense, you know, compared to our current lifespans. Initially, it's very much a stage by stage process. And initially, the goal is to make the human lifespans that we do have, you know, the latter stages of it for us to be in relatively good health, not to be in the sort of disease and decrepitude that a lot of people do spend their latter years in. De Grey is saying he believes technology can be developed sometime quite soon to allow people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s to be in what we currently would be, you know, very rare cases of good health, that there's no need for us to spend decades going quite severely downhill.
Right. Yes, that's right. He is an advocate for good health, you know, most of all. So his idea is certainly not to extend the human lifespan, but keep us, you know, living in misery for centuries or something like that, which I think is often a vision people have of immortality is, you know, we'll live forever, but we'll be older and older and older, and it'll just be horrible. That's not his idea.
And his organization is the, just to use the acronym, it's the SENS Foundation, basically. Uh-huh. So perhaps we should just say a word about that structure there, because it's not, he's not a one man sort of band in his own little private lab or anything like that.
Right. The SENS Research Foundation is a organization that I think he started, and it's a collection of scientists and researchers who are working on tackling the problem of aging, and they have a particular model that they use, which is basically a repair model for aging. So they're not attempting to change the basic structure of the human body so that damage doesn't occur to the body or that we don't age at all. It's just simply to try to repair. I mean, it's not simple in the details, but it's he likens it to keeping a car in good working order. A car that's originally designed to last maybe 10 to 20 years will last for a century or longer if you keep it in good repair and, you know, do enough upkeep. And when it starts to rust, do something about that. And that's what he's saying we should do for the human body.
Now, if not least in fiction, there are accounts of immortality that are famously fairly horrific along the lines that you mentioned a few moments ago. And it's almost like when objections are raised to this research and this work, they come in various types. There's technological objections saying we can't do this, even though, again, it's a spectrum, isn't it, of technologies, a spectrum of treatments or whatever. So you can't, to say that we can't do this is kind of, well, it's not just one thing. Then you get moral and ethical objections, and they tend to sound like objections to immortality. They don't generally sound like objections to just having a healthy old age, as it were. And I'm just wondering why you think those come up. I mean, people seem to immediately go to some kind of, to some extreme scenario when they listen to these ideas being set out. When I say people, I mean lay people as opposed to interested parties.
Well, I don't know. I have my own theories about why people react that way to the prospect of treating aging as a disease and repairing the damage the body does to itself. And they're different from Aubrey de Grey's theories. His reasoning is this, just that aging and death are horrible, but they've been an immutable part of the human experience forever. We've developed psychological and cultural coping mechanisms, and the promise of an actual solution to aging is one which kicks off an irrational emotional response because it undermines a coping mechanism that we've developed. So basically, what we're wanting to avoid are false hopes about our own prospects for a long life without aging and disease. Again, you know, this sounds very fantastical. It's not as though if we could conquer aging or start to repair the damage the body does to itself, that that would end all disease or even all death from disease. It would just bring down the likelihood of death from disease dramatically. It's the same way that, say, understanding what an infection is and treating infections with antibiotics did a tremendous good for humanity and brought down the likelihood of dying from infectious diseases. The same thing would be true if we could have a repair model in place to undo the damage the body does to itself as time passes.
Well, we can't. I don't think we can. I'm no expert in this area, but I don't think we can say for sure about other sentient creatures what they might sense about their own mortality. You've got the whole elephant's graveyard thing, you know, and I think some animals certainly seem to recognize when they're ill, and you know, if you get a cat or a dog, particularly a cat, if it's ill, will go and hide somewhere. We do not quite understand why they're doing that. But the bottom line here is that it seems that we are perhaps unique. We don't know, maybe whales, perhaps, but we haven't learned to communicate with them properly. But we may be unique in sort of knowing that we're going to die, you know, and we have all our lives, should we choose to do so, to kind of contemplate it. And that in itself is like a major issue, because even when animals get sick, you know, to what sense, in what sense might they be aware that something's happening to them that was different, that's happened before? For all intents and purposes, we could assume that they're not aware at all. So from quite a young age, we get a sense of our own mortality, don't we? And that's, you know, that's something that weighs on us. Hence the need for, as you say, a coping strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about you, but I started to worry about aging and death. But aging as well, at the age of like 3, I cried on my 3rd birthday because I realized that this getting older thing was a kind of a runaway process. And if I was 3, that meant that one day I'd be 30. Of course, now, you know, I'm 46, and so it's got even worse than I thought it would be when I was 3. But I guess I can only count so high. But yeah, it is a problem for human beings. And maybe it, as I do say, you know, it might be a problem for elephants, or certainly, you know, the full range of life in the universe is not known to us. So who knows, how the problem of mortality is worked out, everywhere, so to speak. But yeah, it is certainly a human problem. And I think this is the thing that I want to get back to. You asked what I thought the reasons were for the resistance that the prospect of an indefinite human life span met with, and I have my own theory, which is very different from Aubrey de Grey's. It's one he wasn't really willing to entertain when I brought it up to him in our conversation or in the book. But it's the part of the reason why I wanted to talk to him, because again, I'm a left wing publisher. I'm interested in positive social change. I think that there are institutions and structures in the world now that, while they function okay, they do, and some of them are almost, you know, like miracles in a way. There's a lot of downsides to the way we structure our society, and I'm interested in positive innovation and change, and this is certainly would be that. But it also undermines the current way of life that we have, and something in it. Sometimes limits are helpful in giving us a sense of security. Not necessarily one by one as individuals. No one wants to die. But a society built around an understanding of the human life lasting a particular amount of time has developed. And to take that away is going to be it's going to be destabilizing. And a good thing to compare it to is the way that people react to homosexuality, actually, because society was built around certain sort of community structures and family structures and sexual relationships that were not just good for the individuals involved, but maybe not good for them sometimes, but which helped us, the community, be stable. But as our society has changed and the basis of our society is less agricultural, less tribal, less small scale, and more massive and capitalist and interconnected, the kinds of relationships that including homosexual relationships, can come into being and work in the world. But they are perceived as a challenge to a traditional way of life. And I think this also is perceived as a cultural threat.
Well, it's funny you mentioned crying when you were three. For some reason, I had a clear memory of this. My third birthday is the first one that I actually remember. And I got a gigantic bucket of Lego for my birthday, and I was very happy about that. The reason I start off on this foot here is because maybe I think we have got slightly different perspectives on all of this, and that might make for interesting counterpoints addressing some of these issues. But I've never worried about death as such, and it's very easy to not worry about it when you're younger, when you're young and strong and fit, and if you're in good health, because life seems very long, doesn't it? Everything seems so far away. You know, the summers last forever, and that all starts to telescope down, of course, as you get older. But I'm pretty much the same age as you, and I'm still not worried about it. Now, none of us can really know how we will face death if we have a chance to contemplate it. As I've said here before, you know, we could step out in front of a bus and it's lights out. But if we have a chance to face death, even if it was just a few days, you know, you're going to die, mate, or a few months, whatever it happens to be, then we'll see who's who when that happens. But as things stand, the best I can say at the minute, being in what seems to be good health, is that I'm not worried about it. So we'll see how all that pans out. And as for aging, well, the aging process feels very gradual at the minute. Now, again, who knows what the future decades, if I'm lucky enough to live, what that might bring. But it's certainly not something that I concern myself with. And I understand that this is one of the things that divides people. People who are terrified of death, they're terrified of annihilation. They think about it, they worry about it in the small dark hours, if you see what I mean. They're terrified of just their being wiped out, of there being nothing left of them. For me, it feels very much like, and you know, this comes up in the book, it feels very much, it's just a cycle of nature. It's life and death. You know, it's what they go back and forward. And that's just the way it is. So the idea of there being no trace of me ever again, well, that's going to happen. So if it's inevitable, then why worry about it? And I understand that what De Grey's talking about here, as we mentioned before, is not immortality. But if I could have another 10, 20, 30 years of good health, would I take it? Of course. That would partly depend on how I was feeling at the time, as far as, you know, how my life was proceeding. And that's a whole other issue, which we'll get into. So I don't know. I mean, I think you would recognize that there are certain people who are quite stoical about all this. And it's like, well, you got to die of something, you know, that type of attitude.
Right. Well, you know, here's the thing about that. My neurosis around death actually would not be overcome if Aubrey de Grey was successful in extending the human life expectancy indefinitely, because the threat of death, the inevitability of death, would actually still remain. We just wouldn't know when it was going to happen. But nothing lasts forever. You know, you're quite right. And even if we don't die from the disease called aging, we might very well die from tripping and smashing our heads open or something like that. I mean, people die in a variety of ways all the time. And what he talks about is how what he would be doing is reducing our chances of death to about the level that they are at when we're teenagers or, you know, young and healthy. Teenagers die all the time, and so would people who had indefinite life expectancy. So the problem of death would remain. It would be a different, there'd be different terms for it. You know, we'd have a lot longer to be healthy. But that problem of death is really interesting in itself. And I actually talked to I wanted to create a book with this person. I forget the guy's name, but he was a part of the people who study Ernest Becker, and they have this theory about death anxiety. He's a psychologist. It's a theory about death anxiety, and a sociologist, and he thinks that death anxiety is central for understanding culture and that culture is in a way a reaction to death anxiety, and that death anxiety is fundamental to human consciousness. And Ernest Becker wrote a book called The Denial of Death, and he put forward this idea in literary and philosophical and psychological terms. These people who are studying death anxiety now are doing empirical research to validate Ernest Becker's ideas. And they've done some that seems to validate the idea that tribalism and cultural identity is strengthened through death anxiety and openness and a more liberal, accepting approach to a variety of different cultures is more likely to happen when there's a reduction in death anxiety. So maybe Aubrey de Grey's project would help us overcome some political and social conflicts. But I don't think it would fundamentally get rid of that problem of death anxiety. And, we might talk a little bit about what that is. And I'll push back on you a little bit and say that you may think that you don't have any death anxiety, but I just hear you pushing it off into the future. You know, it's like, oh, why worry about it? It's so far away. You know, why bother with it? But it's there, you know, it's looming. It is an endpoint. It does define a problem for human beings, I think.
I mean, okay, death anxiety is a problem. I don't really see death as a problem. You know, that's like saying being born's a problem, and some people might see it that way. But, you know, death is. It's a predicament, maybe, in the sense that there's no solution for it. But, and what else is there to do but push it off into the future? That's where it is. You know, now, the future might be in a few minutes, as opposed to, as some wag once said, the future isn't now, it's in a few minutes. But the list is long of things that we can spend our time worrying about. But, you know, as the old saying goes, you know, fear profits a man nothing. I mean, you know, what is the point? I know lots of people are worried about all kinds of shit, and does it do them any good? No, it doesn't. You know,
well, it's a very practical, you know, answer, and I don't completely reject it. I mean, obviously, if you really thought about death all the time, you would be completely incapacitated by that. Again, Ernest Becker, I just grabbed a book. It's always somewhere nearby for me, this book by Ernest Becker, The Denial of Death. I don't know why, but I always end up reading it. And what he says is that, again, human culture and a lot of human psychology and the development of the personality, these are all ways to overcome death anxiety. And, you know, the denial of death is necessary just for life, that to function socially, death has to be put out of your mind. But that it, you know, the strategies for doing that are only so, you know, successful some of the time. And for some people, they're not very successful at all. And that's where mental illness develops. This is, you know, kind of he has a theory here that's contrary to, say, a Freudian theory of the psyche, where Freud would put sex at the center of the human psyche, and sexuality is the primary difficulty for human beings. Becker suggests that death and the problem of death is at the center of the human psyche.
I think sexuality was a problem for Freud mainly.
Right. Yeah. Well, did he have, I mean, I don't really know much about Freud's sex life.
Well, the way I'd sum it up, and I know I'm being a bit glib here, but it's kind of like he had various hang-ups that he then decided he needed to project onto other people so that he could feel that he wasn't alone or whatever. I'm like, you know, read Freud. I'm like, hang on a minute. Don't drag me into this cesspit. I don't want anything to do with this. I'm fine. Thank you very much. You know?
Okay, yeah. Well, that's what's called a defensive reaction. And, you just need to lie down and, you know, tell me about your mother. No, what is funny to me is that you said that Freud was projecting, which of course is a Freudian term, projection. But I don't know. I don't necessarily think Freud had it right, but there are different theories about, the human psyche and what are the causes of psychological illnesses. And there's a certain Freudian bent to Ernest Becker's work, but he does end up refuting or disagreeing with Freud about the centrality of sexuality.
Oh, certainly, yeah. I mean, I was reading something just today about the enormous problems caused in people's lives by their parents and what each generation hands on to the others in terms of neuroses and subconscious issues and all the rest of it. And certainly beyond that, death is enormous. However unacknowledged it is, as we pretty much alluded to a few moments ago, if some of the technologies that De Grey is keen to develop extended life, healthy lifespan by a few decades, then you've got that becomes normalized at some point, doesn't it? And it's like, the average human lifespan then goes up and what? Death is, once that becomes standard, then everyone's, we live on average to 120. And then, and what has changed fundamentally? Yes, it'd be great to sort of, to not have a long, slow, agonizing death for the most part. But, just in the same way that when at a time in history when lifespans, life expectancy was a lot lower, people just adjusted to that. That was the norm. They didn't think of the possibility of living to be 50 or 60. Or even 70, because hardly anyone did it.
It's interesting. Well, first of all, Aubrey de Grey's expected life, he says our average life expectancy, if everything works out in his project, might be 1,000 years, not 120. And so he's not just talking about, because I think 120 is about as long as anyone lives now, like this is the maximum life expectancy that anyone might have. There might be a few people who've lived a little longer than that, but that's about the maximum that anyone can live now. And that's with aging, with the damage the body does to itself as time passes, not being repaired. So if you imagine we could repair the bodies the way he's talking about, that 120 would not be the end of the road. And it wouldn't be so-called natural causes that took people out. It would be accidents and maybe diseases, but different kinds of, not diseases of aging, maybe assassinations, who knows. But death would be have a very different character. But I want to stay on this thing about the denial of death a little longer, because I do think that the fact that people have to deny the reality of death in order to be psychologically whole and function might have something to do with why Aubrey de Grey's research meets more resistance than you would expect. I mean, it meets more resistance than research on treating cancer, right? Yeah. And the reason why is because it touches on, I think, this primal anxiety around our mortality much more directly than treating cancer does. Although, in practical terms, one of the things that overcoming aging would do would be to minimize people's risks of cancer and in a sense cure cancer. That's sort of put to the side. I've had conversations with people about this where they suddenly are championing cancer.
Well, it's interesting. You're just talking about cancer research there, that quite a lot of the resistance, from what I can see, seems to come from the medical profession and even other people doing genetic research. And some of their objections read, as I mentioned earlier, like they're objecting to the idea of immortality. It's very much kind of, they're not particularly nuanced. They seem quite knee-jerk. And you would imagine that the medical profession would be on board big time with this, that De Grey would be going from one facility to another sharing his information, and that, there'd be like billions going into this, in the same way that if people have often said, if you could develop a cure for cancer, how much money could be made from that, quite rightly, because people will be lining up to pay for it. And I do wonder if the focus on, when I say small success, I mean relatively small in terms of, treatment of diseases and conditions, that quite narrow focus is perhaps due to our lifespans, in a way. It's almost like psychological. It's like, how many years will I be doing research? How many years will I be a consultant? How many years will I be a surgeon? How far can we advance this in my lifetime? Whereas not just science, but all sorts of human projects, human culture in general, would be radically changed if we were living 1,000 years. And I'm not looking to, by the way, just swiftly kick denial of death into the long grass. It's just a point that's come up in my mind, you know, just like what this.
That's fine. I'm glad to move on from it. And we can come back to it if we want to. He has in the book, Aubrey talks about how conservative and, what's the word I'm looking for? Well, conservative will be good enough. And meek, the scientific community is. Those may not be the best terms, but he's looking for profound transformation of medical science and a new approach to treating the diseases of old age. The approaches that are dominating now look to address symptoms, prolong health, and address the diseases without going to their causes. So he's trying to do something that goes beyond that. The other thing is, his approach is not the approach of a specialist or of a researcher. He is the approach of an engineer. So he draws on a variety of different research in different fields to try to come up with solutions to complex problems that cross from one part of our body, one system to another. And so what he's trying to do is very ambitious. It's very complex, and it won't have immediate. I mean, it will have some positive results, or you know, there'll be some victories, but they will be a while down the road. They won't be immediately transferable into the system as it is now. And so all those things make him unique, and make him a figure that maybe a lot of the more established medical community resists. He thinks that will all go away once he has some success with mice. And, there has been success with mice recently. I saw an article. I'm not sure, how true this is. I haven't verified it, but I heard that, or I saw an article saying that they had undone it. The aging process in some mice, that they had reversed the aging process using stem cells in mice. And if that's the case, then that should be a good indication that this sort of medical technology is closer to us than it had been.
Well, one thing that is not very far away, and again, this is touched upon in the book, but one thing that's not very far away or too much of a leap from some of the objections from the medical profession is getting into the area of transhumanism and other kind of modifications to humans to extend and improve life, however you want to define improve. Aubrey does mention this. Because I think in the book you might even make a fairly bold statement like you're associated with transhumanism. He says, no, I'm not. And right. I understand that. But that, again, it's even if the comparison or putting the two things together in one paragraph would frustrate him, anything I've read about life extension technology has ended up talking about Ray Kurzweil and transhumanism in general, man merging with machines, uploading the human mind to the cloud, the idea of a hive mind or an overmind and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's lots of different things, but they get wrapped up together. And for me, that's where a lot of the objections come in, because it's the idea of, like, you know, where does a human end and something else begin? Because, you know, what if part of the de Grey's life extension technology turned out to be, you know, an artificial heart or something like that? What if it turned out to be bits of metal that are inserted in there? And just that, then that's itself is a continuum, isn't it? At what point does it stop being the original person? I'm thinking actually of, I was trying to see if there was anything that was any life form that was effectively immortal. And there is actually a jellyfish that, regenerates itself, but crucially it's, in a way, it's not the same, because it is and it isn't. It's not the same body, strictly speaking, but it's kind of the same jellyfish. So if the jellyfish was called Dave and you could have a conversation with it, then it would confirm, yes, I'm Dave the jellyfish and I have the following memories. but the body has changed, if you see what I mean. So yeah, I guess the central thing to draw out from all of that is, you know, the transhumanist thing. And that certainly gets a lot of people, that gets their hackles up.
I would say Aubrey de Grey is very amicable to the transhumanist movement, and they are amicable to him. They like him. And that, you know, in his off times, he may very, you know, when he's not doing longevity research, he may very well have fantasies about uploading his mind or having a robot brain or who knows. But that's not the approach that the Sins Foundation is taking. They have a particular model, which is a repair model using, technologies that they're developing and technologies that already exist. So stem cell research is a big part of what they are looking at. I don't see anything in their literature about replacing parts of the body with machines. But it's all about repairing the parts of the body that are damaged, through time. That being said, the philosophical problem is if, you know, you have a boat and you repair it to such an extent that every board on the boat has been replaced, is it the same boat? That's a problem that exists, yeah, like you said, for that jellyfish. So if we are replacing all the cells in the body, with the technology, then to what extent are we the same person from one day to the next? I don't know that, I'm not enough of a scientist to know whether or not the human body already currently replaces all of its cells or not. I think the brain does not, but, a good portion of our cells are replaced. So you might be able to ask, was this the same arm as I had 7 years ago or something like that? So anyway.
Well, yeah, there you're getting into sort of philosophical and theological areas somewhat, yeah, aren't you, in the sense, but it's clear that if you or I lose a limb, we don't stop being Doug or Greg, you know, because our left arm, our right arm, whatever, is part of our body, but it's not kind of who we are in a way. When we see people when they have brain damage or they get some sort of brain disease, and their personality changes or their memories are erased. It's common to say that it's not them anymore or the person who they were is gone. And then you're getting into questions again of who we are and consciousness, right. You know, where that comes from, where the seat of consciousness is and what defines us.
There was a little girl who had massive seizures and they were so extreme that her quality of life was utterly diminished. She was a threat to herself and others. She was constantly having seizures. And so the solution that they came up with was severe, drastic. They cut out half of her brain, to stop the seizures. And she was still able to function. And apparently there was not a personality change, or at least not enough of one that they would say she's not the same person anymore. She went to school. She could read and write. You know, she was a half-brained person, but didn't seem to lose IQ or anything like that. So the question there is, for me, when I saw this, you know, where is the person? And, you know, how much can you lose and still be the same person? And it's a question I couldn't answer, but I felt that was a very drastic measure and that in a sense they'd almost killed her in the process of curing her, but she still functioned. So I don't know.
Well, I first heard about that in rats, where they had rats trained to make their way through mazes and what have you. They then removed half their brains and they were still able to do it. And then I later heard about not this little girl, but another, I think it was a grown man I can't remember why, but you know, he'd lost half his brain. Maybe it was a tumor or something and he was normally functioning. Everything appeared to be the same. Well, then we're getting into another conversation, aren't we, along the lines of what I mentioned? You know, I must admit that I read the theories about the brain being a receiver of consciousness rather than a generator of consciousness to be very interesting and quite persuasive, having been reading about them for decades. But again, we'll have to keep that for another day, really.
Well, do you have are you essentially a religious person, or do you believe in a soul or a spirit that is not material?
I'm not religious, but, and this is going to sound terribly unscientific, but that's fine. Why does everything have to be scientific in any event? I have a sense along the lines that I just mentioned that there appears to be, that the body appears to have a function. The body and brain appear to have functions that are limited, quite amazing, but limited. And how can I put this? It's just, there's a bigger picture to existence or reality, or however you want to put it. And I know that sounds like, well, what do you mean by that? Well, I can't explain. But just to answer your question, not religious, but I have a sense that the hardcore materialist who said that, you know, who would say that this is all there is, I have a sense that that's not. But research goes on in that area. So we'll see. But I have always said to people who've just gone, oh, that's rubbish, I've said, look, if after death there's a black void of nothingness, fine, whatever. If that's what actually follows death, then so be it, because I can't change that. Oh, and by the way, I'm not going to be around in the black void of nothingness to complain about the black void of nothingness, if you see what I mean. So right. Either way, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever follows death, it is what is.
We'll right. See. Yeah, well, okay, let's go back to the denial of death, because it just came up again. Here's my problem with death. It's not so much that at the end of my life, there will be a black void of nothingness. But as you say, I won't be around even to complain about it. Even that's not so terrifying. What's sort of terrifying is that from my limited subjective experience, it will be as if I never had been. That it will be, that death will extend in both directions. It will mean that I will have no future, but it will also mean that I will have had no past. Death seems to make this moment in time that I'm actually experiencing seem insubstantial to me, almost illusory. And that's where I think my anxiety comes from, is that you work in the world, you do things in the world, you develop relationships in the world, but death is always hanging over your shoulder, not only promising to end your fun, but to eradicate your existence in all directions.
We're kind of retracing some territory that we did earlier. For me, it's kind of like, well, you know, this whole thing in that case is so unlikely. It's kind of, it's like a miracle. You know, I don't want to use, you know, religious language necessarily, but it's like, wow, what a trip. You know, what are the chances of this? You know,
that's, you know, I just feel like that's a little bit of a Pollyanna response, but okay, I understand what you're saying. It's like, okay, maybe it's true. Maybe when in the future, you will be eliminated as if you never existed, but you exist now. So, you know, why worry about it? Well, that's a very, you know, common reaction. I think it's probably the right one. So, you know, like practically and psychologically, I'm not sure it does. It just for never has gone far enough for me. It's never quite felt satisfying for me to get that reaction. I'm reminded, have you ever seen the movie Annie Hall?
You know what? I haven't. Pretty much everyone I know probably has, but I've read many references to it, let's put it that way, but I haven't seen it.
There's a scene in that where there's a flashback to the main character, you know, to Woody Allen's childhood, and his mother has brought the doctor to see him in their home back when doctors made house visits, and he says he's completely depressed. He won't do anything. He won't go to school, won't do his homework, he won't eat. And he's worried about the fact that the universe is expanding. And the doctor says, why is that a problem? He says, well, if the universe is expanding, then one day the universe will expand so far there won't be anything. It's like our whole life will have meant nothing. Everything will disappear as if it never existed. And the doctor says, the mother says, what is that your problem? You know, the universe, and the doctor says, well, the universe won't be expanding for billions of years yet, Alfie. And we've got to enjoy ourselves while we're here. And of course, the way it's played out is these two people who are advocating for life being meaningful despite all that and just to not think about it are sort of depicted as idiots. but of course, they're right. It's useful to be that kind of idiot because otherwise you end up, you know, in a depressive morass and that you can't escape from.
Oh, yeah. Of course, I'd forgotten Woody Allen, right? Now, I enjoyed Play It Again, Sam. But in general, Woody Allen makes me want to punch Woody Allen.
Right, really?
Yeah.
Just because he's so neurotic?
Oh, I can't stand it. It's just, will you give over for, you know, just, you know, yeah, that's my reaction basically. It's like, you know, just get a grip.
Okay.
No, and I realize that's, it sounds very simplistic and I can see how it's easy to, well, it's simplistic because it is. Again, you know, it's like we get a tendency to overcomplicate things, don't we really?
Yeah.
But I
want to point out that this conversation we're having about my neurosis around death, my neurosis around death might explain why someone like Aubrey de Grey is attractive to me, and he is, but ultimately Aubrey de Grey won't help me. I mean, this whole project of an indefinite human lifespan won't overcome the problem. And I think that's important for me. I mean, you don't even have the problem, but for me, it actually would be no solution. It'd be nice, and we both of us would like to live as long as we could and be healthy. But it's not going to actually solve that problem of death.
No.
If it exists, yeah.
Maybe we could throw out a couple of practical points now. Well, you know, they might not actually be deemed practical by de Grey himself, but just things that cropped up in the book that kind of interested me. And these would particularly apply if he and his colleagues enjoyed some considerable success and really made headway with this. One of the issues that comes up is that of overpopulation, and this is one of the popular objections, and he almost seemed quite weary in as much as anyone can seem weary when they're just being quoted in text answering this question. Population is an issue, and I'm not a Malthusian thinking that lots of people have to be wiped out for this to save the planet or anything like that. I just think that birth rate is going to decline over time. You know, that's generally what will put things back in some kind of ecological balance. But when these sorts of practical objections come up in the book, whether directly or indirectly, he talks about renewable energy, for example, you know, just in passing, and says, well, you know, we'll have developments here and that's going to help with this issue. And also, but technology in general is dealing with some of these practical concerns.
Yeah.
But for me, that's a bit like saying, oh, well, my finances are in a mess, but I might win the lottery. Well, you might win the lottery, but it's not really a plan, if you see what I mean, to deal with your finances. If your bank manager says, well, you're heavily overdrawn, what are we going to do about it? You say, oh, I'll buy a lottery ticket. For me, saying that we're staring down the barrel of these major problems in various aspects of our civilization, what are we going to do about it? And just, oh, technology. Yeah, there you go.
Well, I think that Aubrey de Grey would say that it's nothing like wanting to win a lottery ticket, because the research and work that's going on in the fields of alternative energy is real. They're not simply leaving it to chance that somebody will, you know, fall upon or a solution or some great alternative energy source. But work's actually being done there. So it's more like saying, yes, I have financial difficulties now, but I have invested in these different businesses. Surely one or two of them will be successful. And that's, I think, sort of what he's saying. He's saying, look, these new problems will come up. Some of them will be real. But we will also have had that amount of time to work out, these projects of alternative energy. They're already going on. So we can expect that some solutions will come, because that's how we get these solutions. We work on them over time.
Well, I don't want to add to your death dread.
Anxiety.
Yeah, death anxiety or whatever, but this is a common refrain. This is being worked on, and in the ensuing years.
Our top men are working on it.
Yeah,
top
yeah.
men.
Top men, as they say in Family Guy, you know, top men. But what I would put money on this, actually, I don't know if Aubrey would put some of his millions, because he sort of inherited millions, if he would put some of his cash where his mouth is, because he talks towards the end of the book about, we'll see, hopefully we'll see this, I would expect, in the next 5 to 10 years. And you hear this in terms of alternative energy, in terms of transhumanist people use these sorts of, I mean, Kurzweil had this ridiculous thing in his book, The Singularity, I think it was, and what's his projected, I've got it written down here somewhere, his projected time. That's right, the Singularity, 2006, and aging effects would be completely remedied by 2030. Well, okay, I hope, how's that going? You know, because it's getting it's a lot closer than it was before. So I just wonder whether in 5 to 10 years from now, we might be looking at some of these projects, including this research, SENS type research, and saying, you know, some progress has been made. We'll see significant developments in the next 5 to 10 years.
Right. Well, I see what you're saying. It's hard to say, right? I mean, so far, there hasn't been the breakthrough that DeGray has been promising, as far as I know. Although, again, I did see an article about repairing the damage that aging causes in mice and having that some success with stem cells recently. So that may be a major breakthrough. There have been some major breakthroughs, but so far I've not seen any announcement from Sens that they really developed their technologies and had it work in mice yet. And that would be the real test, the first major breakthrough that they would have to have to be credible, you know, for people other than weird left-wing science fiction writers. I mean, they are credible enough that some people are investing in them and, you know, innovative thinkers and entrepreneurs and, you know, billionaires have put some money into their research. But, you know, you're right to be skeptical. It could very, very well take longer. The question is, you know, what is it worth the risk of investing in this kind of research? I mean, both in terms of alternative energy, but also in terms of longevity. I would say that, and what I told him was that if they were successful in treating the problem of aging, the argument that technology can overcome limits that seem impossible to overcome would be a very much stronger argument. You could point to that research and say, look, the likelihood that we'll be able to develop alternative energy, say get solar power to really be functional, is much higher than we've ever thought, because look what technology and science has done. And so that's basically my position, is that if maybe this isn't a strong argument. In fact, I know it's not, but I had this instinctual thought that if we can overcome aging, surely we can do something about energy problems and energy depletion. The other thing, though, to point out is that some of these overpopulation problems are overblown, because if our life expectancy were to increase dramatically, our birth rates would drop as well. People would wait even longer than they do now. I mean, in the industrial world, in the first world, birth rates are dropping, and they're dropping because of our longevity and relative comfort and economic success and the change in the way that our economy works. So those changes would come as well. I think that the overpopulation problem would be one that could be overcome.
So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that there was a major advance in this research and they were able to put a particular treatment package together and just say, we have something ready to administer to patients, and it delivers the following benefits, and you can expect anything from X number of years to Y number of years of good health, you know, all things being equal, barring disasters. Here we go. It costs this amount, so you're not going to be able to get it for free right now because the technology is expensive, but here it is. It works. This isn't going to be suddenly ruled out to the billions of people all over the planet. So I'm just wondering then about how this would differ from other types of elite healthcare that people can take advantage of at the minute. Would we just have then Bill Gates and Zuckerberg and other people like that going in for this life extension technology that basically is so exclusive and so expensive? And then we end up with a situation a bit like in, what was that film that came out a couple of years ago when the elite ended up moving off planet? Because they had taken advantage of advanced technology. But it reminded me actually of that book that I read a few years ago that I sent you the link to, Robert Heinlein's Methuselah's Children, where you ended up with a two-tier society where the first generation to fully benefit from the technology, the early adopters, were going mad amid this old world of people who just didn't live very long at all. And the old world really resented these new kind of superhumans, as it were. And again, this all sounds very sci-fi, and Heinlein's book is sci-fi, but I could just see that as a source of resentment.
Yeah, well, now you're in the UK, right? So you've got the NHS, and if you need medication for a disease, now that's covered by the state.
Yeah, to some degree. But I mean, for example, we have private healthcare. One of the big providers here is called Bupa. I'm not dissing the NHS here at all. If anyone's, works for it or has taken advantage of it, that's fine. I'm simply saying that I've known some people with, cash to spare who've opted for private healthcare because they perceived benefits or there were actual benefits, you know.
Right. So when would you go to private healthcare? Would it be for things that the NHS doesn't think are life-threatening enough or necessary.
Or something that something that you wanted done in a time scale that the NHS couldn't promise. So they'd say, oh, if you want a hip replacement, you've got to wait 6 months. If you go private, chances are you could get it almost straight away.
Right, okay. So, yeah, so in the UK, if there's this medication that can undo the damage the body does to itself from aging, I would think that people who are suffering from age-related diseases would be the first people through the NHS system to be given the new treatment. And that some people at first would indeed go to private sources to get the treatment. But it would be a political battle to expand the treatment through the NHS. That's just all that would be. And, you know, it's not, it wouldn't be actually that different a battle than the one we have now, about holding on to the NHS, making sure the NHS functions, for the majority of people, that it's adequately funded. The other thing is, a lot of the, costs of healthcare are in the later stages of life. They come up when people are very sick. And if this treatment was available, it would reduce those costs in the system. And it might actually ultimately be a less expensive route to go, than letting people get sick and have to go through a far less effectual process of care.
That would certainly cause some vexation in the pharmaceutical industry, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
They're suddenly selling a lot less pills and potions to millions of people who are actually in much better health than they used to be. You know, because obviously there's big money there. A conspiracy theorist would say, you know, that it's in pharmaceutical industry's interest to keep people, keep them alive, but sick. So they're spending a lot of their, you know, a lot of their money, on remedies. So that,
right.
That would be an interesting one to see how that would play out.
Yeah, no, it would definitely, there would be probably, political battles over this, but, you know, I think that if it really was working and it was known to be working, that no one could stand in the way of the public on this. You know, if you're going to be offered the opportunity at the age of 70 to feel like you're 40, again, and to have the health that you had when you're 40 or 35, or say, you know, you're not going to, and the only thing standing in the way of that is the economic interests of some pharmaceutical companies. I'm sorry. I think that those pharmaceutical companies would have to change what they were about and come up with new business models, because there would be tremendous pressure from just everybody, including people who work for the pharmaceutical companies, to make that change. It would be such an obviously right thing to do that I can't see people really tolerating it.
Now, there's a bit, to get away from a practical point just for a second, though it has practical aspects to it. Aubrey is resistant to talk of meaning and purpose in life, in the book anyway. And I'll just give a quick quote from him about that. And it is, the meaning of life, that kind of nonsense. I'm not really into the meaning of life. I'm just a practical guy. I enjoy my life and I'd like to carry on enjoying it. And I think a lot of other people feel the same. So I'd like to help them carry on enjoying it too. And that's about as far as my thinking goes on the matter. Well, I would just throw in that I think he does derive meaning in his life. Otherwise, his life would be meaningless. And I don't think he's the kind of guy that would find that tolerable. I think his purpose is very clear. I think he's defined his own purpose. And people don't want to simply exist. Now, millions, maybe even billions of people are currently on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. They're right down at the bottom. Their focus is on shelter, on food. They're simply existing. Maybe they can't even think about doing more than that, but certainly we'd agree we wouldn't want to just have nothing else other than raw survival, especially not when we've had a taste of the privileged lives that we've been able to take advantage of. You know, we might not be billionaires, but we're still amongst the richest, most materially privileged human beings on the planet. So how would technological advances, particularly if they became quite affordable to extend life, how would they help the people who are currently living in slums, who are living in war zones? It's kind of like, oh, well, would you like to live another 40 years on the Gaza Strip? Some people might say, yeah, go for it. Do the people living in the center of Syrian cities at the minute, the ones that are being bombed to hell and back, do they want to live another 40 years like that? Well, they probably don't want to die, but they want their conditions to change. They want their living conditions to change before they can think about anything else.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about how people's lives are different all over the planet and how billions of people, you know, have lives that you and I would find unsatisfactory and unfulfilling. Yeah.
Right. Well, okay. Here's what I would say to that. It's, first of all, it's important to understand the context in which he said he's not interested in the meaning of life. Because it's not the context wasn't me asking, so what gives your life meaning? And does this project of creating indefinite life extension give your life meaning? I think he would have said, that it does give him his life meaning and that that is the meaning of his life. In fact, I've heard him say that he chose to go into this field because it was something he could do that no one else was doing. It was going to maximize his effectiveness in the world and put his life to the best use, which to me, all of that's about finding meaning in your life. I mean, that's what that is. So you're right. He doesn't actually not care about having a meaningful life. He also considers himself some sort of hedonist, I think, but he's not a philosopher and he hasn't spent a lot of time debating these issues. And frankly, I'm glad for it because I'd rather him be working on the indefinite life extension, you know, for my own neurotic reasons. Okay, so there's that part of the answer. The other part of the answer is this, is that what I was asking him was whether or not he thought that there would be challenges, cultural challenges to overcome in order to get enough support behind his project to make it happen, or if it did happen, if there would be cultural challenges or unintended consequences for people who no longer could rely on having a certain kind of life in front of them that up until that point had given them a sense of life's meaning. Even if they didn't like the end of it, you know, they knew what the pattern of their life was supposed to be. I have four kids, and so there's this book that I've read to all of them. It came from my childhood, so I ended up here. And it was a very simple story about a child being born, a child growing up, finding a career in the zoo, getting old, and retiring. You know, the death part's left out, but you know, he grows up, he goes to school, he goes to college, he meets a woman, he gets married, he has kids, he has a career, he gets old, he retires. It's very, very simple story, very simply told, and it is basically a map of a successful life that you read to your kids. It's one of these normative stories, right? And that kind of normative story would have to be changed dramatically. You wouldn't have, you know, it's already changing. You don't necessarily have one career. You don't necessarily have one marriage. You know, marriages are different now. It can be between two men, two women. All sorts of things are different from that little story. But this would add yet one more complication. You wouldn't have an end goal of retirement. You wouldn't have a set amount of time. And without that set amount of time, you might not have as clearly demarcated cultural checkpoints to, you know, confirm your life as meaningful. But he didn't want to talk about any of that. And for him, it wasn't a problem that he was interested in. So you had one other. I've answered half the question. What was the other part that I was supposed to address?
Oh, I that was off the top of my head, to be honest with you. I don't necessarily recall, but I think you've addressed the thrust of what I was saying.
Okay.
I was querying if I remember, I'll mention it. Well, in thinking about people who are perhaps in reduced circumstances, and this is not to
That was the other part. You talked about reduced circumstances for people and whether or not people who were on the Gaza Strip or living in refugee camps or, you know, et cetera, all the people in misery in the world, whether they would want to extend their misery through this life extension medication, basically. And the answer to that is, I think most of those people would, because just like if you get cancer and you're living on the Gaza Strip, you'd prefer to have the cancer treated than not. I think people like life most of all, most of the time. You know, there are people who don't, and those people might not choose to get treatment, but they wouldn't be choosing not to get treatment in a way that's different from choosing not to get treatment for cancer or, you know, any other disease that they might get that's life-threatening. It would be rare, even in the Gaza Strip, for people not want to be healthy and still alive. That said, life extension wouldn't solve those kinds of problems in and of itself. You know, it's not a panacea to fix the culture. In fact, I think it would make some things more unstable. But regardless of that, those other problems would have to be worked on just as they have to be worked on now. And the benefits outweigh the, just like the benefits of any medical advance outweigh the downside. I mean, it's just sort of inhumane and sort of monstrous even to say, yeah, we shouldn't have any medical advances until, you know, everyone's living meaningful, equal lives. So we should just cut off medical research, and let people die, because after all, you know, we wouldn't want to have people live in misery forever, or, you know, with that logic, you know, we might as well kill some of these people who are living in misery now. So it's, yeah.
And I suppose that your point would also apply then to people who are disabled or deformed or disfigured in some way, or who have other diseases that are not related, you know, other terminal diseases that are not related to aging, that we don't start.
Well, look, if people are suffering and they have a disease that somehow, even after we treat the damage that the aging process does them, that isn't mitigated or, you know, made better in any way, well, then the same questions come up again that are exist now. I mean, in Belgium, there's euthanasia for a wide variety of things to mitigate suffering. And that those euthanasia projects might still exist even as life is extended. So it
just changes the time frame of everything in our culture. It doesn't fundamentally affect it. So, you know, that would also apply then to people who've committed extremely serious crimes, you know, murderers, rapists, pedophiles. They get locked up. It's just they might spend 800 years in prison instead of, you know, 40.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a question. Would we give life extension? You know, what kind of treatment? I think we would end up giving those people treatment just as we do for other diseases. I think that would actually be a big problem for society. We'd have to work on reforming criminal behavior much more than we do now. We kind of let natural life span get rid of all these problems. I mean, you know, if you're a murderer and you're locked up for 40 years, when you're let out, you're just not going to be in the condition to be the same threat as you were before, right? Mm-hmm. But now you might be. So, what would be the proper response to that? That would be a real problem. And there would have to be work done on that.
Yeah, I remember a friend of mine, she did some work in prisons, and one of the inmates that she dealt with was, and this is a notorious case here in Britain back in the 50s or 60s, I can't remember when, but it was the Moors murders, a couple who killed a bunch of children. And anyway, this guy called Ian Brady, at one point all he wanted was just to die. You know, he'd been put in prison when he was relatively young. He was never going to get out. He just wanted to die, but that was kind of not permitted. You know, no, this is a life sentence. We don't execute people anymore in this country. You're staying there. And I just thought it was interesting. And I don't know whether this was just a simple oversight or whether it was just a turn of phrase, but whenever Aubrey mentioned in the book about causes of death, and he said, well, yeah, because if we were able to implement these strategies and this technology, other deaths then would be by accident or homicide. He didn't say accident or homicide or suicide, because there will always be some people that would find the idea. Again, this is a problem that maybe applies to a transitionary phase, that might find the idea of living with a particular condition or with a mental health condition, it might cross over into intolerable if they thought they were going to spend hundreds of years, you know, centuries dealing with it rather than decades.
You know, you can refuse treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, yeah, I think it's right to put that suicide would still be available, and you can, you know, you don't have to, it wouldn't be a mandatory treatment, and you can, you know, it would be, I mean, it might be in some societies, but the idea is not that this should be a mandatory treatment. It would just be an option, and I think one that most people would take. So, but yeah, suicide would be, maybe become, it's conceivable that suicide would become the primary cause of death. That's possible.
I wonder if it would have, if an extended, and this is just a flight of fantasy here that I didn't actually think about while reading the book, but I wonder if such an extended lifespan, let's just say, you know, 10 times or more than 10 times the current average, if that would affect human evolution. Because I from earliest times reading about evolution, I've often wondered, I mean, are we actually the finished object? Is this it? or are our bodies going to change over time, over the, you know, over the coming millions of years, assuming we make it?
Well, you know, evolution is a random walk. It's just whatever lives and lives. So my assumption is that we're not done evolving, and that, and we're weirdly in a position where we can affect the course of our own transformation. I wouldn't call it evolution because it wouldn't be random anymore. So, you know, I think that changes to the human body are probably inevitable. How dramatic those changes would be in the millions of years to come, it's impossible to say. But if I were to write a science fiction novel set in the, you know, say, 200,000 years from now, I would be tempted to go, you know, the old Star Trek route and maybe write about energy beings that, you know, went in and out of different bodies or something like that. I mean, who knows?
I wonder what, drawing this to a close for today, really, I've just had another thought. We talked earlier about culture and what would change. You know, like, you know, all sorts of human modes of expression, art, and, well, you name it. It's like all our, you know, our institutions, you know, we talked about the medical profession, and then we talked about the law, and just everything that really defines our civilizations would undergo a change. For better or worse, or perhaps it would just be the same, except over, about imprisonment over a longer time span. And I wonder if there was anything innate in us, in our brains or our psychology, that would actually fail to adapt to a significantly longer lifespan. This is not something we're going to find out unless we get the chance to try it.
This is a big problem for Aubrey de Grey, because treating lots of the causes of death that come up now might be relatively easy, but if you extend the human lifespan, the healthy human lifespan, by a couple hundred years or 1,000 years, there becomes a question about the functionality of the brain over that period of time. First of all, just treating the problems that happen in the brain, the way the brain is damaged through time, is really hard, and that's going to be like the problem that will be possibly the most difficult to overcome. But, and then the other question is, how much memory can we have? What are the limitations of the human brain just in that regard? How much will our personalities change simply by living that long? I mean, I don't know about you, but I feel that in many ways I'm the same person I was when I was in my 20s or a teenager or even a child. But in many other ways, I'm not. And I would think that problem would continue, or not even a problem, but that phenomenon would continue as you lived longer and longer. Living 1,000 years, we would be different kinds of people than we are now, I think.
I really sympathized with your point, because we're a similar age, that you made in the book about you feel that in middle age that you're finally beginning to get a grasp on many things about what it is to be human, what it is to be a man in the world, you know, just, and who you are and all the rest of it. But you're already beginning to feel the physical effects of aging. So I have total sympathy with that. You know, I've never felt more confident, more competent, more capable than I do now, not necessarily physically, but in other senses. And yet I feel that, you know, I'm kind of just getting started in a way. And there's lots of other human cultures that have recognized that, you know, the elders, you know, those that have lived the longest in many ways are the best in terms of, like, if they've preserved their mental faculties, you know, all the experience they have, the wisdom they have gained, the mistakes they have made, the successes they've had, they can bring all that to the table in a way that somebody who's 15 or 20 can't. If your nightmare, however, is death, mine is, I was reminded of something I read when I was a teenager, Michael Moorcock's Dancers at the End of Time series, when this people who have achieved immortality have become decadents. They're deeply corrupt. And they find that they have no motivation for any action other than just flights of fancy and pointless whims and random destruction. And it's just whatever. It's just absolutely degenerate. And,
yeah,
you know,
I don't think that's necessarily likely, or, you know, that I don't think that vision is anything more than speculative. But I do think that my question to Aubrey about changes to our culture that would result from this, and the unease that people might have about the trajectory of their life or how to understand their life in a when it's been extended so far, was one that he brushed away a little too easily, because some of the things that give our life meaning and value today are connected. As much as there's death anxiety, there's also a lot of cultural meaning around death and around the limits of the kind of life we have now. There, you know, it's like saying, what if we didn't have to reproduce sexually anymore? We could still do it for fun, but that's not how we reproduced. Because technology could intervene and we could, I don't know, masturbate into a cup and put it in a device and, you know, in 6 minutes a baby would pop out or something. So what would that do to our culture? And how would that change our relationship in families and with children and so forth? You know, would children be less valuable? What would be the result of that? And it's uncertain, right? It would have, but it certainly would have profound consequences. I can't think of a good reason why to give up sexual reproduction, but, you know, if there were good reasons for it, they might outweigh these concerns. We should be aware that we're not simply going to go forward into this hedonistic liberal utopia necessarily, that, you know, we do rely on cultural norms and we are messing about with them and that we need to be prepared for that.
Well, certainly no reason to give up kind of rehearsing for it, is there, sexual reproduction? No. That is, you know, you don't want to lose those skills through lack of use.
Well, yeah, I think that happens as you get older. That's another problem with age. So, you know, the lack of use would be another reason to, you know, to support Aubrey de Grey. It would improve your sex life in the long term.
So, Doug, we're just going to wrap things up for today, but sure. I just want to give you the opportunity, if you wish to, because there's so many things we could, you know, continue to talk about. If there's anything that you'd like to add, just before we finish off.
Well, I just want to say that this was a very refreshing conversation for me to have today. Since the election of Trump, people on the left are mostly very discouraged, and it was nice to talk about a subject which, you know, wasn't without its problems and isn't just all happiness and light, but which is fundamentally an optimistic thing to talk about. And so I appreciated the chance to be optimistic for an hour and a half.
Okay, Doug. Well, today our conversation has been based around a book you recently published. We are in conversation with Aubrey de Grey, and the book's entitled Advocate for an Indefinite Human Lifespan. That's out on Zero Books, widely available. If you'd like to share Zero Books' website or one of your own and just anything else you'd like to put out there.
Sure. The Zero Books website is zero-books.net. You can just type in Zero Books into Google and you should find it. There's also a podcast called Zero Squared. And if you go to iTunes and type in Zero Squared, or if you type in Advancing Conversations, I think you'll find our podcast. My name's Douglas Lane. That's spelled L-A-I-N, my last name. And if you type in douglaslane.net or douglaslane.com, you'll find my webpage. And yeah, I encourage you to listen to the Zero Books podcast and to check out all the different books that we're doing, putting out. Our most recent book is called Uncertain Futures. And it's definitely worth reading. It gives an economic and Marxist account of the recession and crisis that we've been going through since 2008, and how that has led to this dramatic turn to the right, both in the United States and in Europe.
Splendid. Well, Doug, once again, thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
All right. Thanks for having me.